This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
There is optimism, and then there's the facts. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. We have a triple header for you this week. The Watchman is going to rattle out danger with a brainwave escape hatch as I interview California author Rebecca Costa. Transportation planner Jeff Tumlin gives a short, stark warning about how cars make us fat, sick, and dead. Good commuting fare for all the folks. And we'll wrap up with some happy news from the inner doomster, NASA's project to black out your city before the next solar storm begins the long emergency. Could it be the knockout blow we've all been hoping for? I don't mind if the future is scared and miserable. I just want my toilet to keep on working, and now the sun wants to screw with my plumbing. Do you think I'm crazy? Keep listening.
Radio EcoShock. Add to all this the turmoil of the past 6 months and the fact that no one seems to know what happens now, and we have a bleak picture indeed.
One town soaked with 20 inches of rain in the last 48 hours. That area has been declared a disaster zone.
He said the bitterest truth is that we can't prevent global warming. The challenge is only how to keep it from getting worse.
Many of us feel civilization could be approaching collapse. We face problems so big we may not be able to solve them in time. Rebecca Costa searched for the demise of past cultures, picking up some clues. She sees a possible way out for our own times. Her new book is The Watchman's Rattle, Thinking Our Way Out of Extinction. I'm Alex Smith. Rebecca Costa, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about your life journey. What led you into this book?
Well, I began in 1975 with E.O. Wilson's publishing of Sociobiology, The New Synthesis. I began as a sociobiologist. But as soon as I graduated college, much like many undergraduates, I had to go find a job, and I happened to land near Silicon Valley. So I would say high-tech hijacked my burgeoning sociobiology career. But I found myself in the middle of really exponentially accelerating complexity. In Silicon Valley, we were introducing new technologies at first every 6-8 months, but then pretty much by the week, new advances were coming out. I was fortunate to develop my own company, sell it, and move away. And after stepping away for 5 and 6 years, it really became clear to me that complexity was advancing at a rate that was just not sustainable by the human brain. As you know, evolution takes many, many millions of years, so therefore the brain requires millions of years to develop new facilities, and yet the complexity in terms of just making new discoveries, finding new factual information, new technologies, was advancing at such a rate that it just simply wasn't sustainable by the biology that we've evolved to this point.
Well, I got a quickie question for you. What is the Watchman's Rattle?
That's a great question. The Watchman's Rattle, the reason that the book was named The Watchman's Rattle comes from earlier times when the first police force, rather than carrying weapons, they carried these large wooden rattles that made an alarm in the middle of the night to let citizens that were sleeping know that there was some danger. And the citizens would wake up from their sleep and come and help the watchman. So it was basically a summons for help.
And in our own times, we have the economy looking pretty fragile. We've got climate change. We've got possibly peak oil and overpopulation. It goes on. It's a long list. Are we too worried about collapse? Is it a real possibility?
Well, as you know in my book, I am less interested in the specific cause of the collapse. I see the causes of collapse as being simply lots of planes stacking up in the air, all trying to land on the same runway. Eventually, if you get enough planes in the air, one of them is going to cause a catastrophe. So the real key is, well, what caused all the planes to begin stacking up? And so I'm interested in the conditions that lead up to the eventual cataclysmic event, whether that's the Mayan drought or the fall of the Roman army. It really doesn't matter to me which event gets you. The important question to ask is, what caused that event to eventually become so powerful that it could not be stopped.
Let's backtrack, if we can, to Roberto Vacca's 1973 book, The Coming Dark Ages. He argued that overcomplexity would cause civilization to crash, but he didn't know the computers would help us control our world, and of course the collapse did not occur then. So you come from a Silicon Valley high-tech experience. Do you no longer think computers can help us manage complexity?
Well, I have a love-hate relationship with computers. I don't know how I'd get through a day without them as a science writer. But on the other hand, simply even going on the Internet to find information is overwhelming these days. I think the example that I give in my book is that I went to investigate the different terrorist groups that have cited the United States as an enemy so that I could be more educated in the positions that the United States took on national security, and there were 134 of them. I don't see how computers help me get through 134 traditions, agendas, and history of 134 terrorist groups. I just don't see how computers can narrow that down for me.
So we may not be able to make sense of it even at the top, no matter what the computers are doing. Well, I sense a new powerlessness of most authority, perhaps even the federal government in the United States, but in a lot of authority, and in our own lives, we feel like we can't do much about anything. Do you feel that?
I feel that we've reached a cognitive threshold, which earlier civilizations have also reached, where we are succumbing to complexity, and computers to some extent exacerbate that complexity by generating so much information that we can't really get to the facts. And when you can't get to the facts, you then cannot make rational decisions, including in public policy. So the helplessness that we feel is simply succumbing to the complexity of our circumstances. Let me give you an example. Right now in the midterm elections, there absolutely comes as no surprise there are more people not turning out to vote than are voting. My explanation for that is I frankly, cannot make head or tails out of the ballot initiatives. They're very complex. There's too many of them, and I refuse to make important decisions based on 30-second commercials and lawn signs. So when you're in that situation, you become a bit gridlocked, and you reach some impasse that you can't get over because you can't get to the facts to make a responsible decision. Even in that circumstance, democracy begins to fall away to zealots who are okay making decisions off of lawn signs. And this is hugely problematic.
And you've given an example on a simpler level of just trying to figure out what kind of milk to buy.
Exactly. I mean, I went to the store and there's, 20-some-odd types of milk to buy. There's, 1%, 2%. One of the problems I have is I don't know if 2% is 100% worse than 1%. And then there's non-fat, there's acidophilus, there's goat's milk. There's soy milk, which really isn't milk, it's soy juice. I really don't know what kind of milk to buy. I don't know what type of toothpaste is the best for me. I'm overrun with decisions that I have to make on a day in, day out basis, and increasingly I'm making them based on very little data and only on my intuition and beliefs, or maybe hearsay from a friend of mine.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Rebecca Costa, author of the new book, The Watchman's Rattle. Get more from her website, RebeccaDCosta.com. Rebecca, one of my listeners heard you in that panel discussion at the Harvard Coop with famed sociobiologist E.O. Wilson. You proposed a new cognitive strategy or even power that might save us after all. Please tell us about that.
Well, neuroscientists are making a very shocking discovery that there's a third form of problem solving that is ideally matched to highly complex problems. And we're at the point now where about 300 milliseconds before you're going to evoke this form of problem solving called insight, we can identify a part of the brain called the ASTG that lights up beforehand. And it's really an important discovery because if you think about it, over millions of years, we've been evolving left and right brain problem solving to a point where it's very comfortable and it's very natural and it's very automatic for human beings. But when you have multi-layered, highly dynamic and chaotic problems, the left and right brain problem solving that we've evolved to this point isn't really much help, and that's where we've come increasingly to rely on computers to give us as many scenarios as we can so that we can fit that into left and right brain problem solving that we've evolved to this point. Insight is kind of a shortcut in a chaotic situation. It's what neuroscientists call an aha moment, where suddenly out of nowhere we make a connection between data that we have in our brains that we've never made before, and we just kind of shortcut through all the things that are irrelevant to the problem.
It seems, though, like our institutions, from our schools, which have cut out the play breaks through the corporations, are working three jobs, and then you get mass media at night to fill your head. When do we have time for insight?
Well, we're not at a point where we can generate insight on demand. In fact, one of the things that people that show up at some of the talks that I give, they complain that I don't tell enough about insight. And in fact, we've only discovered insight in the last 4 and 5 years, and we're trying to learn about more of the things that will induce insight. We do know that there are some things that help the human cognition from a biological standpoint. For example, we know walking. Walking helps to increase blood flow to the brain. But also, when you think about it, a third of our brain developed over the course of 4 and 5 million years when we became bipedal. So there's still an association between walking and the amount of cognitive resources you have to use to just stay upright and be able to walk on uneven surfaces like cobblestones, and the amount of exercise that the brain gets. And so it's not illogical from a strictly biological standpoint to understand you give your brain a great workout when you just simply walk on uneven surfaces.
And your book also suggests that even in companies, people should have work breaks. They should just take some time out because they'll get some better work done afterwards. Is that right?
They will. Actually, a number of Silicon Valley companies have instituted what are called standing desks. And what they are, they're desks that are about chest high that you can put your computer and everything on. And underneath it is a slow-moving treadmill where you are actually walking while you're working. And people, there are so many benefits to that. I mean, we're so used to sitting and becoming a very sedentary society that just simply moving your feet while you're making critical decisions seems to have a great benefit from a cognitive standpoint.
Although I got to say, that sounds a little scary, too.
Well, since we all like to sit and not move, a lot of people say, gee, I can't even imagine walking while I'm having to, you know, use my computer. And it takes a little getting used to, but I have to tell you that it's showing some remarkable benefits. Even in schools, they put children, instead of on chairs, on large balls so that while they're sitting at their desk, they can be moving around and the brain is having to calculate how they balance on those balls. And that actually shows a lot of cognitive benefits as well. So sitting is not our ally.
As you mentioned, in these recent midterm elections in the U.S., we didn't see a mass outbreak of insight by any means. Do we have to hope, perhaps, that a minority with greater insight manages to overcome the problems of a still superstitious, I would say, population?
Well, I don't know if you want to get me started on the midterm elections, because from my standpoint, all we see is the oppositional behavior that I describe in my book under the chapter Irrational Opposition. As the facts become increasingly difficult to gather, most civilizations begin turning to beliefs, and this is what leads to irrational public policy and eventually the demise of the civilization. We seem to be tracking that in that same way. Most of the candidates that were running for election simply opposed the other candidates' ideas and any position that they were going to take, and they offered almost no solutions. And we've become a society that has really confused opposition with advocacy, and this is a really dangerous road to take.
I wanted to ask you, Rebecca Costa, how you know E.O. Wilson, and why do you think he is embracing your new book, The Watchman's Rattle?
I know Dr. Wilson from 1975 when I was an undergraduate at UC Santa Barbara, and he came out with his book, Sociobiology, The New Synthesis. I was able to make his acquaintance a few years ago as I was starting the research for The Watchman's Rattle. I believe that Dr. Wilson feels that we will not be able to solve our most dangerous problems unless we get past the groupishness that we inherited from our prehistoric ancestors. We are a organism that likes to form groups around particular ideologies and then battle and take over or annihilate other groups that have different ideologies. And this goes way back to our prehistoric ancestors. And we have the vestiges of those instincts right now, and they are not serving modern man in a constructive way.
And I'm also very worried about climate change. I think it's one of the big challenges that faces us. Are there things in this book that I can apply toward solving that problem?
Absolutely. One of the things I talk about when we hit a cognitive threshold and we become unable to solve our most complex problems that we can mitigate in a way that accepts high failure rates. And I use the example of venture capitalists, for example. Venture capitalists are experts at failure, not success. For every 100 companies they invest in, they expect 80 to fail or not do well, and 20% to lick the problem and become a highly successful and profitable on Wall Street. So in a climate where you can't pick the winning solutions from the losing solutions, and climate change is a great example because we can't even agree on whether climate change is occurring or not, the only way that you can attack a problem which exceeds our cognitive abilities is to attack it on multiple fronts with an expectation that some of the things that you attempt to do are not going to work, but the ones that you do select that are effective will mitigate the problem effectively enough that it will buy you time to get to a longer-term solution. So you really have to attack it on all fronts.
I think some people have spoken about that when they talk about wedges, the different things that need to be handled each separately that could add up to a solution. I wanted to say, too, are you starting or hoping for a new movement? And if so, what might that look like?
Well, if there is a new movement, I think it's an old movement. I think we have to at some point acknowledge that we are biological organisms all trapped in the same evolutionary spacesuit, and it can only acquire new features in million-year increments. Therefore, over a long period of time, our brains begin to fall behind the complexity that humans are able to generate. And in a circumstance like that, we need to mitigate using high failure rate models, and we also need to consider doing more things to arm the brain against encroaching complexity so that we can have rational decisions and rational facts return to public policy.
I admit I'm a little dubious we're going to think our way out of this mess. Why should we believe you?
Well, I don't know that anyone should believe anyone. I think you have to go and get the facts. Again, it doesn't solve anything to just believe what somebody says or to follow a unproven belief of any type, including what I've written in this book. I have to tell you, I'm much more comfortable if people examine the facts I present in the book and then go and acquire facts of their own. Each of us is responsible for accepting a hypothesis to a certain point and then going and verifying that and making sure that that is correct and it's appropriate before we adopt any further belief.
Rebecca, as we wrap up, is there something I've missed? Is there a message you'd like to leave with our listeners?
I think if I were leaving a message, it would be to get off the couch. There is something that you can do. It is not gloom and doom. We have lots of time to change the course, but we must change the course based on rational thinking, facts, and not succumb to the complexity that is making it difficult to acquire those facts.
You have been listening to Rebecca Costa, the California sociobiologist and successful businesswoman who took some years off to find out why civilizations collapse. It's all in her new book, The Watchman's Rattle, Thinking Our Way Out of Extinction. Find out more at RebeccaDCosta.com, and notice that Rebecca has two C's in it, and the middle initial D is in that web address, RebeccaDCosta.com. Rebecca, I know you still have a whirlwind of media appearances ahead of you. Thank you for taking the time to join us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Alex Smith. Download this interview as a free MP3 from our website, ecoshock.org. Last year I got some great recordings at the Resilient Cities Conference in Vancouver, Canada. You heard people like Richard Register and Sam Adams, the mayor of Green Portland. This year, the Gaining Ground organizers were attuned to the troubles, calling it Healing Cities. I'm going to play you one of the best short speeches from that session. Jeff Tumlin is an award-winning transportation designer, Stanford grad, and, as you'll hear, a fearless speaker about everything we don't want to hear. Find out how many cars it takes to make us fat, stupid, and dead. The introduction is by Rob Abbott, founder and CEO of Abbott Strategies.
Every now and then you get a chance to meet someone in a collegiate profession and it just kind of leaves you going, wow. Jeff did that to me a while back. We were a few years ago, we first met, you gotta love this, we first met in the desert on the other side of the world in Abu Dhabi. We were planning a region for His Royal Highness, the Sheikh Khalifa, I believe it was, for an area of the world that has 10% of the operating and known oil reserves on the planet. Now, you'd think that a transportation planner and engineer working next to 10% of the world's oil reserves, that'd be sacred ground. But for Jeff, he brought an entirely different approach to this. He started challenging that entire country to rethink how they move around. And that's one thing for us to say here on the temperate climates. But when you are in the desert in September, at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, it sits at around 50 degrees outside at about 100% humidity and blowing sand. And when you want to get people out of their cars to go walk somewhere, that is a formidable challenge. That's about the equivalent of getting people to walk to work in Tuktoyaktuk on December the 21st. It's a big challenge. And yet he was able to change the whole minds around entire cities and regions and how they worked. And that was where I got to see him first in action. Now, I've asked him a little bit about why his whole firm and he in particular take an entirely different approach than what most of us get a chance to work with when we're dealing with transportation planners. He said to me that he gave me the following quote. He said, you know, we recognize that transportation is not an end in itself, but a means by which communities achieve their larger economic, quality of life, social equity, and ecological goals. So they work with their clients to define their goals clearly, find ways to measure how those transportation investments that they're going to have to make, how can they also achieve these other goals. And so when you deal with Jeff and his team, you end up talking almost more about urban design and land use patterns than you do about transportation because of the whole interconnection of those. We can't simply solve congestion issues, mobility issues by adding more capacity. We actually have to take a look at the whole system that is fundamentally part of that. And so Jeff is going to take us further into this link between cities, movement, health, and spirituality in talking about some of the work and the ideas that he's been engaging in. Please welcome Jeff Tumlin.
Thank you, Mark. So I'm going to talk about a lot of problems, particularly health problems that are rooted in the decisions that we make in all of our cities about transportation, say a few words about how we got stuck in this predicament, and talk about the benefits of active transportation and end with a few things that your cities can do. I have about 70 slides to cover in about 20 minutes, so we're going to move quickly. So sit back, relax, and put your thinking caps on. So why does active transportation matter? One of the things that I love about the health industry is they have really, really good data. And unlike my industry, they actually do follow-up studies to see how their predictive tools actually worked, and then make adjustments accordingly. And so in the United States, the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta has compiled trend data about a whole host of diseases, including obesity, and tracked that over time. So in 1986, we can look at the darker states that have significant rates of obesity, 1991, 1997, 2000, oh, we have to change the scale in 2004. 2005, we changed the scale again. Time is speeding up. 2007, 2008, 2009. Obesity is a severe problem in the United States, and it is a problem that's rooted not just in diet, but even more so in activity, and that corresponds even more greatly with some of the diseases that are correlated with obesity and lack of activity, particularly diabetes, 1994, 2001, 2007. A third of adults in huge parts of my country diagnosed with obesity. Another with diabetes. Another delightful disease that is causing increase in affliction is asthma. And one of the interesting studies back in 2000, during the Olympics in Atlanta, like in the 80 Olympics in Los Angeles, the transportation officials there said, oh my God, transportation chaos, it's going to be gridlock, it'll just be horrible, nobody drive. And so as a result, nobody drove, and in fact, the freeways were empty in Atlanta during the Olympics, and the health professionals there actually went to all the hospitals and collected data about who came to the hospital and under what conditions. They found a dramatic drop during that period of no driving in asthma, while at the same time, there was little, if any, drop in other reported conditions of the hospitals. So driving results in asthma, and it also results in a whole host of other conditions. And while the newspaper headlines get us all afraid of, shark attack and plane crash and, some mountain lion attack or something crazy going on in our community. In fact, for teenagers, the number one cause of death among teenagers in the United States is motor vehicle crashes. And fourth among all causes of death in the United States, and more importantly, a whole variety of related conditions, cancer, congenital anomalies, heart disease, are all related to transportation factors, particularly the lack of active transportation in our lives. The social sciences have also started to track data that relates to transportation. In fact, created a name for an entirely new condition called road rage, which there are endless scholarly articles that describe exactly the array, the soup of toxic chemicals that our own brains produce when dealing with the unique stresses associated with driving. These stresses and these health problems are worse if you happen to be young or old or brown or poor, and particularly if you're old. In fact, one of the greatest problems that most cities in North America are about to face in the coming decades is the number of people who are going to be over 65 and who are stranded in communities where walking cannot be a part of daily life. The science of gerontology teaches us that the minute we stop walking, we basically start dying. It's a huge problem. And I don't even need to get into the whole conversation about the relationship between our transportation decisions and global warming. In California, about 40% of our CO2 emissions are transport sector, and of that, 70% is us driving around. So what's at the root of all these problems? How could we have allowed the frog to be sitting in the pot of water while it's now at a full boil? Well, there's a simple answer, and it's this. Even though we know that sprawl equals death, that the fatality rate in our sprawling locations is 3, 5, in some cases 10 times greater, the traffic fatality rate, than it is in our more walkable urban centers. And that the lower density community we live in, the more driving that we do, the fatter that it makes us, the more unhealthy that it makes us. And that the social costs of all of this are astronomical. In San Francisco, the public health department has been keeping track just of the actual hospitalization and healthcare costs of pedestrian fatalities. It totaled $75 million over the course of 5 years, just dealing with cleaning up, the physical cleanup of pedestrian-related crashes in one city in 5 years, during a period of time when the transportation department had very, very little money to spend on pedestrian safety efforts. Instead, we're spending $75 million public money in the public health hospital in cleaning up after the fact. So what next? Well, the reason for all of this is not because the market has demanded that we live in auto-dependent communities, but the fact that our laws require it. In nearly every city that I work, this one is a very unusual exception. It is illegal to create the kind of walkable communities that we know the market is demanding and that Hank has told us in the United Kingdom the market is absolutely demanding. And all of this in spite of the fact that every planning document that I ever read has all the good words in it. It's, you know, mixed-use neighborhoods and density near transit, reducing vehicle miles traveled, reduce CO2, promote walking and biking, blah, 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 motherhood and apple pie. And yet, when we go into the actual law, into the funding formulas, into the street design standards, into the nuts and bolts of the zoning code, this is what results. This is a walkable community because you've got a mix of uses up there, and there's a pedestrian and a crosswalk. So we've met the goals of our general plan in delivering what we've required. And so we wonder, however, if perhaps there is a bit of a mixed message. So, what's the solution? Well, as our previous speakers have already mentioned, in fact, all of them, there's a powerful relationship between density and the rates of driving. And the sweet spot that occurs in our old streetcar neighborhoods, in townhouses, in the places where that still accommodate the car, and yet don't require a car for all trips. You don't need the density of Manhattan in order to have a walkable, healthy, sustainable community. Another thing that we've learned, and you'll notice the same shape of curve, is that the best thing to do to make walking and biking safer is to create more walking and biking. The best thing to do to make walking and biking safer is to create more walking and biking. In fact, if you double the rate of walking, you decrease your risk of a traffic fatality by 66%. Another important bit of research that hasn't been updated since Donald Appleyard did it in the 1970s is the relationship between how we do transportation and our community health. You'll notice in the top diagram, this is from Donald Appleyard's famous book, Livable Streets. He actually interviewed every household on streets of varying level of traffic, and he found that in a street with a relatively light amount of traffic, still a fair amount of traffic, the people living on that block had 3 friends on that block per person and about 6.3 acquaintances. You increase the traffic, however, on a similarly designed street, and the number of friends drops to 0.9 per person and only 3 acquaintances. And more importantly, when he interviewed people in more detail, the amount of trust on the block with less traffic was extraordinarily high. People would lend their keys to their neighbors, you know, when they were on vacation, take care of their dogs and water their plants and so on. That didn't happen on the block with lots of traffic. We also find increasingly in the medical research that not only is exercise really important for a whole lot of cardiovascular reasons, but green exercise, outdoor exercise, even for short periods of time, is strongly positively correlated with better self-esteem, happier moods, and this is true particularly for young people and for people who are suffering from mental illnesses. Another interesting factor that I am completely fascinated by is a remarkable neuropeptide that our brain produces called oxytocin. This has been in the press a fair amount recently. It is the biological reason for trust and generosity and empathy. It lowers blood pressure, and it increases social behavior such as friendliness. In fact, it's so powerful that it's now being marketed out there on the market where you put this little spray. And I won't show the other images that are associated with it, but you can imagine that this ad is not for oxytocin, but it's a remarkable chemical in that the most powerful way that our body releases it is, of course, during sex, also during breastfeeding, but particularly with human eye contact. Humans are unique among animals in that the contrast between the white, the pupil, and the iris of our eyes is greater than any other species. We get an enormous amount of social information through human eye contact, something that I will point out can only happen on foot, in person, and at 5 kilometers per hour or less. The other way, however, that we release oxytocin in our bodies is through exercise, particularly walking and bicycling. So, if driving, the science tells us, makes us fat, sick, die early, poor, dumb, angry, and mistrustful, and if walking and biking makes us fitter and smarter able to handle complex reasoning better, the science tells us, sexier, more loving, and more trustful, then why are we still designing our cities around this rather than this or this? If these were the design vehicle for our transportation system, imagine how much more healthy our cities would be and how much happier all of us would be. So what can you do? Well, the first place to start is to measure success properly, to make sure that everything that you care about in your community is defined clearly in a statement of goals that then follow through to related measurable targets and that have implementable strategies associated with them, and then most importantly, have quantifiable performance measures by which your city officials can judge whether or not they have achieved those goals. If something's just nice and can't be measured, it's going to be ignored. Step two, fix your street standards and your street and transportation performance measures. This street, in fact, basically all of your favorite streets in any city that you've ever been to, is likely illegal in that community. It violates every rule of proper street design, and particularly it violates the rules of safe street design. Look at the factors that you love about your favorite streets and make sure that not only are those factors legal, but that your city traffic engineers are required to design streets that you will love walking along. Number three, rethink traffic mitigation. So one of the things that my industry does, spends a lot of time doing, it's our biggest moneymaker, is analyzing the traffic impact of new development. And we typically analyze the impacts of new development according to a single factor, intersection level of service for motor vehicles, by which we measure the seconds of delay that cars experience at an intersection. Not the seconds of delay that people experience at an intersection. So a bus with 40 people on it, those people are valued at 1/40th as relevant as a car with one person at it. Interesting way to look at things. So if you're looking at seconds of delay, the solutions for fixing traffic congestion are to widen roadways, to reduce density, to add parking, or best of all, to move the project to a more isolated rural location where there's not current traffic congestion. Of course, the implication of any of these is to worsen the very problem that we're trying to solve. This is at the root of the unsustainability of all of the practices in my industry, and it needs to change. Step four, legalize walkable neighborhoods. The city of Vancouver is the best model to follow in all of North America. If your zoning makes it impossible for someone to reasonably walk to get a quart of milk, your zoning is unsustainable. Step five, get smart about parking. This is an all-day lecture in and of itself, and perhaps the most powerful tool that cities have at their disposal in order to fix some of their sustainability problems and their economic problems in a very, very fast way. So some of the things that we talk to a lot of cities about, eliminating minimum parking requirements. We don't have minimum housing requirements for people. Why do we need minimum housing requirements for cars? Creating park once environments in our business districts where somebody can park their car once and do six different things. Charging the right price for curb parking to make sure that there are a few parking spaces available on every block, in every parking lot, in every parking garage to actually not use the Soviet communist method of allocating scarce resources as we currently do for parking, but not for housing or food. And instead, let the market work for us. And finally, manage your parking in order to achieve your city's larger development, congestion management, other goals. And finally, step six, make walking a joyous and delightful part of everyday life. And Brent talked about beauty. Hank talked about joy. And I would talk about delight because the most important factors of sustainability are these factors that generate love. We know from sustainability science that the most sustainable thing that we can do is to maintain what we already have. And things don't get maintained if they're not lovable. make your buildings lovable, make your communities lovable, and create cities in which we can all love each other. In order to do that, you all need to be at the table when decisions are made about the built environment and be advocating for that humans matter and that our health, our spiritual, our physical, our mental health all matter in decisions about the built environment, recognizing that the built environment is managed by dozens of different bureaucratic agencies, people in silos who are not talking to each other, people who have over-professionalized their work and have complex formulas designed so that you cannot understand them. You need to understand those formulas. The ones in my profession are really quite easy. What we do is not rocket science. We've got a lot of big words that try to obfuscate and make it seem like it's harder than it is. It's really not. You can all fix the problems in transportation that that create these unsustainable factors. So the other critically important thing to keep in mind is that time is running out, and we need to move beyond platitudes and move beyond general statements about yay sustainability and instead get into the DNA of how our communities are built and funded and how the success of those communities is measured, making sure that human physical, emotional, and spiritual health are factored into those formulas. Rome burned while Nero fiddled. And we have the opportunity to lose an awful lot if we fiddle around with public health in our communities, and yet so very, very much to gain if we understand these factors and get them right. Thank you.
That speech titled Alive Transportation, Fitness, Safety, Community, and Trust was by Jeff Tumlin, a principal at Nelson Nygaard Transportation Planning in beautiful San Francisco. It was recorded by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock on October 7th, 2010 at the Gaining Ground Ecological Conference in Vancouver, Canada. Tired of cheerleaders and phony media issues?
We treat climate change almost as if it's something external. It's a sort of problem that we've created that we can solve with human genius. But I don't think it is. I think climate change is our society. Climate change is who we are.
Looking for the awful truth? Dig in with Alex Smith.
Actually, you're never going to get millions of people on the streets to campaign against climate change because they'll be campaigning against their own way of life. And so we're all complicit in that system. The voters are complicit, the corporations are complicit, the politicians are complicit, and we might want to stop climate change, but actually I don't think that we can, at least within the timescale that's apparently available to us. And I think we need to be honest about that, because only when we're honest about that can we start to think about what we do next.
Top scientists, authors, and activists, the ones you want to hear. No fear, Deep Green Radio EcoShock. Join us. Doomsters rejoice. I found another reason to stock up with food and emergency supplies. The bad news comes from those fringe nuts at NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. In late October, NASA announced a new project trying to protect our electrical grid from violent solar storms. It's called Solar Shield. What else? The good news? NASA thinks they might be able to help prevent long-term damage to the American electric system. The bad news? It isn't working yet, and might not prevent a serious hit anyway. How serious? This is where I love reading U.S. government reports that never make the mainstream news. The NASA headline is so catchy, quote, "Did you know a solar flare can make your toilet stop working?" Well, that would be really bad. I don't want the sun to screw up my toilet. It gets worse. It turns out NASA paid for a study by the National Academy of Sciences. That came out in January 2009, titled Severe Space Weather Events, Understanding Societal and Economic Impacts. Buried in those charming 132 pages is hair-raising stuff. 130 million Americans could lose power for months or longer from an event they don't know anything about. When it comes to a big hit, Al-Qaeda is nothing compared to the sun. That's the terrorist. Just think about what a prolonged worldwide blackout means. The National Academy did, and it's ugly. They have charts showing how various layers of society stop functioning in pretty short order. Things like satellites, bank machines, gas pumps, television and radio stations, cash registers, furnaces or air conditioners, and oh yeah, the pumps that deliver water to your taps and your toilet. All that could go down the drain for several months, the experts say. I question whether the whole grid or the economy could ever return again following such an event if it should happen.
Around the world, as electricity stops being generated, the modern world comes to a standstill.
As you considered how many buckets of beans you will need to put away, let's get some background. What is this about? Science writer Dr. Tony Phillips has a couple of great articles about this whole issue on the NASA website. I'll be drawing from his work, and you can find links to it in my EcoShock blog for this program at ecoshock.info. You'll also hear a couple of quick clips from a 2006 Discovery Channel disaster special, The Perfect Disaster, Solar Storm.
The next cycle of extreme solar activity is predicted to happen in 2011.
The existence of solar storms is not a new discovery by any means. Back in 1859, British astronomer Richard Carrington happened to be projecting the sun's image on a white screen to study it. He saw a giant eruption from the surface of our star. About 24 hours later, telegraph lines became electrified, some operators were shocked, and papers in telegraph offices caught fire. Dr. Phillips says the bright night light could be seen from Hawaii to the East Coast. In the Rocky Mountains, campers started to make breakfast in the night, thinking that strange glow was morning. It was called the Carrington Event. Remember that, the Carrington Event, because it was probably at least 50% stronger than the solar storm that hit the Earth in May of 1921, and that's kind of a standard used in this report. A co-author of the National Academy report, John Kappenman of Metatech Corporation, calculated the probable damage today if a 1921-sized superstorm hit us. He found two big areas of, quote, probable power system collapse, the Pacific Northwest and the whole east coast of the United States extending to the Midwest like Ohio and Michigan. Power system collapse is not what you want to hear. The story goes like this. We have enlarged our power system by about 10 times since the 1950s. The U.S. has a gigantic network of power lines, as do many modernized nations of the Earth. These grids act like antennae, attracting the electricity from the solar storm. The more power lines and the more equipment, the denser they are, the more likely they will be hit. It isn't just a matter of knocking out electricity for a few hours. The burst of energy goes for the heavy transformers at the core of our system. These monster transformers, many tons each, with all their copper windings and iron, just melt into useless metal when they get hit. I've seen a photo of a big transformer at an American nuclear power plant melted by one of these solar storms. Nobody can repair them on site. New ones have to be manufactured, transported, and installed. They're big and expensive. Many are custom built. It could take months or years to replace them, if we have enough materials at all. And what would happen during a giant blackout worldwide? The likely social collapse? Our current world production capacity for these big transformers is from 70 to 100 of them a year. Tens of thousands of transformers worldwide are at risk. You do the math. A much smaller flare hit the electrical system in Canada's Quebec province in 1989. A satellite photo shows that whole part of Canada in utter darkness. But the hit was small. They recovered in about 9 hours. A Carrington event, as happened in 1859, Kappenman calculated about 350 big transformers would be killed in the United States alone. That would leave around 130 million people without electricity, likely for months, with, quote, water distribution affected within several hours, perishable foods and medications lost in 12 to 24 hours, loss of heating / air conditioning, sewage disposal, phone service, fuel resupply, and so on, end quote. To quote a bit from NASA writer Tony Phillips, a contemporary repetition of the Carrington event would cause extensive social and economic disruptions, the report warns. Power outages would be accompanied by radio blackouts and satellite malfunctions. Telecommunications, GPS navigation, banking and finance, and transportation would all be affected. Some problems would correct themselves with the fading of the storm. Radio and GPS transmissions could come back online fairly quickly. Other problems would be lasting. A burnt-out multi-ton transformer, for instance, can take weeks or months to repair. The total economic impact in the first year alone could reach $2 trillion, some 20 times greater than the costs of a Hurricane Katrina, or to use a timelier example, a few tarps. End quote. And that's just America. The rest of the world could be plunged into darkness as well.
Not just New York, every major city on Earth. It's gonna last for weeks, months, years. No electricity, imagine that. It'd be like winding the clocks back hundreds of years.
On the NASA site, we have a diagram that represents the web of complexity hidden from our view. The caption reads, "A web of interdependencies makes the modern economy especially sensitive to solar storms." Source, Department of Homeland Security. End quote. Experts see arrows of ricocheting damage run from the power system to emergency services, all government functions, from the military to those welfare checks, pensions, payments to workers, that all stops. On the other side, threatened or going down is the whole banking and financial system. No lights, no money, no gas, no phone, no water. For 130 million Americans, possibly for months, the whole world could go into turmoil, with some cities temporarily abandoned, without food or power. The sun has just gone through a decade-long quiet period with hardly any of the sunspots that mark solar storms. Here on Earth, we had less of the northern lights and the southern lights, the impressive colored reflections of solar emissions passing through the upper atmosphere. We don't really know when solar storms will happen. One NASA expert predicts the next storm could hit as soon as 2013. There's already a growing net literature and mythology growing around that year. Mind you, people in both Europe and North America saw a wild aurora borealis light up the night sky on August 3, 2010. In my blog, I've got a link to a Flickr video from NASA of those violent late summer bursts of solar activity this year, vast explosions followed by tentacles of red-hot light reaching far out into space. When these energies pass the Earth, they disturb, distort, and weaken our planet's magnetic field, the same force that points a compass. Normally, this magnetosphere protects the Earth from harmful solar emissions. NASA has learned fairly recently the magnetosphere can be porous. At times, it opens up windows which allow extra solar activity to reach the Earth. These may open from minutes to hours. We are not sure yet. It seems part of the natural system. But a big solar flare, a Carrington event, does not need a window. It crashes right through the walls. I feel unqualified to speak about the actual science of what happens near the ground where we live during one of those events. I may look for a guest to explain this further. My crippled understanding goes like this. The energy is also drawn from the Earth. It's attracted by the solar power, just as lightning sometimes emerges from the ground. This energy, not as much a rebound effect as an attraction event, goes for the power lines and transformers, just as sky lightning goes to church steeples or the tallest tree. I may be wrong about that theory. But the NASA experts certainly say this. The more power connections we make, especially large-scale applications with giant power hubs for our cities, the more likely these systems will be hit and destroyed by a solar storm. More irony for you in a universe full of irony. We expect natural disasters to hit the least developed areas like Haiti or Bangladesh. This one, which Discovery Channel calls the perfect disaster, solar storm, goes for the biggest cities with the biggest power grids. Perfect Disaster was a 2006 TV episode. The show predicts the next period of extreme solar events should arrive in 2011. Nobody knows for sure. And you can watch that video in five parts on YouTube. It might never happen in our lifetime. Solar storm disasters, well, they've been done to death in many science fiction novels and some really bad movies. Is it just disaster porn? So why is NASA announcing the Solar Shield project? They have the SOHO satellite to photograph the sun's surface, to monitor for CME, the dreaded coronal mass ejection that brightened the world, we think, in 1859. another aging NASA satellite, the ACE, is being set up to measure the solar storm as it goes by, allowing computers to model where the worst impacts will be. All this might give American ground controllers 20 to 30 minutes, we're not sure how long, to shut down the power grid entirely, to isolate the transformers, to make our cities go dark on purpose. Just now, the major power companies are not yet all on board. The decision to shut down American cities would not be easy. Could it happen at all in time if the Solar Shield project goes ahead? Don't forget, a solar storm is a global event. Every major city could go dark from Australia through Asia, through the Middle East, through Europe, through North America, South America, China, all of it. Developing countries could take a decade or more to get the power back up as world transformer production goes to the highest bidder or to military might. Satellites carrying the entire global communication and financial system may be struck dead. None of this is science fiction. It is science, reality on a small planet near an irregular sun. It's just one more way our overcomplex civilization could crash. Just one more reason why I do have a year's worth of food stored away, why I live near a river, why I know how to grow things, why I question any future that cannot accomplish localization, solar power on every house, decentralization, simplification, frugality, self-sufficiency.
We need to shut down. Just do it.
Roberto Vaca called the crash of complexity the coming dark age. That was back in 1973, and he was wrong then. Now the book is online and updated. Roberto Vaca is waiting. Can we prove him wrong? On Radio EcoShock, we'll continue the exploration of complexity and our utter dependence on fossil power from those past ages. Can we save the climate without a giant economic crash, without a tech blackout or a population crash, without a time of horror? Are we living in a deadly fantasy? Some trust the nightmare will turn into a benign dream after all, and it may. Others fear to wake up. I'm Alex Smith. That's about as much of Telstar as I can stand. The excitement when that instrumental by the British band The Tornadoes, well, it was huge in 1962. People were caught up in the new space age, and this song was named after one of the early commercial communication satellites, Telstar, owned by AT&T. The clavioline instrumental was also new to popular music. Maybe it was the ancestor of those great techno bands coming out of the European clubs in the 1980s. The other odd noises you heard came from a project I believe was called Cosmos with a K. Now I've lost track of who did it. Some scientists found rhythms in the waves coming from various distant stars. They hooked up synthesizers and let the stars play their own music according to the frequency received. If you know who did it, please drop me an email, radio@ecoshock.org. The music of the universe, indeed. Many thanks to Radio EcoShock listeners for their guest suggestions. Caleb in New England pointed me to Rebecca, who he'd just heard at the Harvard Coop. And Guy in Australia, so many thanks to you. Next week I'll be talking with Julian Cribb about the coming global famine for an upcoming interview. Keep up your tips, boys and girls, as Radio EcoShock sets out to rule the world.
Actually, we are two laboratory mice who wish to be on your show as part of an intricate plan to take over the world.
And welcome to our 23rd station, and all you Canucks listening on CJUM College Radio in Winnipeg, Canada. We're all in for a wild and bumpy ride. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. We'll close out with a global warming song by FLEP, the Family Life Education Pacifica. Is a health organization based in Auckland, New Zealand. This is a live random recording from their 2009 crew found on YouTube. Pacific Islanders have everything to lose as the oceans rise.
Deep low makes the ocean grow. Global warming makes the ocean grow. And greenhouse gas.
Why is it something we've done? You all seem to forget. Blown.